This is Barry Lissett Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science at Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. In today's segment, you'll hear about battling the swine flu virus and the challenge of protecting our children through immunization. Our guest is Professor Sheldon Jacobson of the University of Illinois. Professor, welcome to the Science of Better.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's turn for a moment to a hot issue that's in the news, and that is swine flu. We're all worried about the return of swine flu or H1N1 virus, which emerged in Mexico in the spring of 2009. What's the latest that you've heard about the threat level, so to speak, and how urgent is it to vaccinate large numbers of people?
Well, we're at a position right now that the season when the H1N1 novel virus is going to, in fact, hit is upon us. Universities, high schools, elementary schools are now coming back into season, whereby you have a larger concentration of people coming together, which in fact is a fertile soil for the disease to spread. So we're now going to find out exactly what all the predictions and all the models said. Will the disease spread as rapidly as we believe, and how virulent will it be? Will it, in fact, be as deadly as people anticipate? And many researchers and experts have predicted that it may not be quite as virulent as is anticipated. Nonetheless, we're only going to find out over the next several weeks.
And roughly how many people are going to need swine flu vaccines this fall and winter? And tell us about the vulnerable groups.
Well, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which makes these recommendations, recently came out with a certain set of what they call initial target groups. This includes pregnant women. The next group are people who live with or provide care for infants which are less than 6 months old, because children less than 6 months old, although vulnerable, will not be given the vaccine. The next group are healthcare providers in general. And then we have basically children 6 months all the way up to young adults into 24 years, and then people who are beyond 24 years up to 64 years old who have some kind of complications and do not have a full immunization system which can protect them. So as you can see, we have a whole gamut ranging from the most vulnerable to the least vulnerable.
And how many people would you estimate in the United States will need to be vaccinated?
Well, at this point, we're looking at somewhere slightly over 150 million people will need to be vaccinated. And the vaccine that is currently under development will require two shots. So there's going to be the initial injection and then the second injection shortly after that. So this is an enormous logistic issue that we're going to have to deal with in this country over the next several months.
And that brings us to your area of expertise. Vaccines start out in one or more places and wind up at medical offices around the country. And to some people, that might sound simple, but guessing by the number of people we're talking about, that sounds like it's a pretty complex operation to put together. So to start not with the swine flu, but with preparation for seasonal flu, what would you normally do? What's the path of a vaccine dose that travels from a manufacturer to a healthcare provider?
Well, it's actually, for the seasonal flu, it's very predictable simply because it's been done so well. The vaccine manufacturing process is well understood. It uses an egg-based system. It starts approximately 9 to 10 months before the vaccines are actually needed. There has to be what is referred to as a best guess of what the particular antigens are going to be in the flu season, which is following. They typically use three antigens, so it's a trivalent influenza vaccine.
And I guess it's difficult determining what those three should be.
It is, although it's amazing how well they've been able to predict what it's going to be based on seasonal patterns as well as just the worldwide flow of the antigens of the vaccine, of the virus. So through this manufacturing process, it eventually gets developed and eventually gets distributed around the country. Now, we saw there were production problems just a few years ago in the 2004-2005 influenza season, and as a result, there were some shortages of vaccines, and as a result, not all the vaccines that were needed were available. But typically, in a given year, somewhere in the order of around 30% of the population gets immunized, and the rest just kind of go about their business. What's interesting about the seasonal flu is that the most vulnerable groups tend to be the elderly as well as people who have immunity problems.
Those are the people you would expect to get ill any time that there's a disease of merit.
Exactly. While with the pandemic, we're anticipating the exact opposite, that it's going to be the young and healthy people which are actually most vulnerable to mortality.
And that's frightening. I think going back to World War I, among the first who were struck were soldiers.
Exactly. If we go back to the so-called Spanish flu in 1918, when the pandemic hit then, the people who turned out to be most vulnerable to death were the young and healthy, because the immune response to the virus was so severe that it was that which in fact killed people, not the virus itself.
Ah, interesting. We were going to take a look at the supply chain, and I thought it might be interesting to trace the path of a vaccine. Does it go from the manufacturer to a wholesaler to the health deliverer? What is the system like? Once again, just looking at the typical vaccination for a seasonal flu.
Well, even before a vaccine, especially a new vaccine, is able to reach market, it has to go through clinical trials to get Food and Drug Administration approved. Assuming that that happens, in fact, we're seeing that right now with the H1N1 vaccine, where it's going through clinical trials around the world. Once it does that, it is then simply distributed. Now, the distribution system is not very complex. It goes from the main center to secondary centers that eventually ends up with healthcare providers. So the complexity is not as severe, simply because it is a well-tried and true and understand process. With H1N1, we're going to have a completely different situation to deal with, because the vaccine, for one thing, is not going to be available before the major strike of the influenza season for the H1N1 pandemic. As a result of that, people are going to be sick. At the same time, the vaccine is going to start coming to the marketplace and be made available. It's got a targeted group of people. So we have simple logistic questions to ask, which are very complex to answer. For example, do we have a single distribution center, or do we have multiple smaller distribution centers? Do people come to get the vaccine, ultimately putting them in a more concentrated area of people, or do healthcare providers go to the people? And then there's the ancillary medical supplies issue, which hasn't really been talked about very much, but is quite critical. For example, masks, which can prevent the transmission of the disease. How do we distribute those? Another issue involving all of this, which has even received less attention, has been the bio-waste that is going to accumulate as a result of this surge of distribution of medical supplies. People really haven't looked at those issues, and the nice thing is that the tools that we have in operations research are uniquely defined and available to help answer some of these questions.
And turning to the supply chain, why are these supply chain issues, not medical issues, but supply chain issues, so important in preventing the spread of a disease and preventing it from becoming a pandemic?
Well, it still is a pandemic. The question is, what is the impact going to be on society? How do we limit the mortality and morbidity of the disease? We can't prevent it. It's going to take a natural course. One of the things that was discovered in 1918 during the Spanish flu pandemic was that social distancing had a tremendous impact on reducing the spread of the disease. The communities that decided to keep people separated basically reduced the transmission rates. Well, any time we bring people together in close quarters, we effectively are increasing the ability to transmit the disease. So if we try to treat people in close quarters, we're ultimately at the same time helping spread it. It's the same thing with the logistics system of moving the medical supplies, the vaccines around. We have to make decisions of how we're going to do that, taking into account that with the disease present, we still have to try and limit the spread of the disease while at the same time we're distributing items that will help prevent it or reduce the impact of it. So in some sense, we have these contradicting issues which are constantly affecting the supply chain.
And is there a model out there yet, or is it still being developed?
Well, many people are looking at the problem from many different angles. We can use very traditional logistics models, but then we have to take into account we're dealing with perishable items. We're also dealing with urgency in getting the items out. And then for every item that's delivered, potentially there's going to be a reduction in the impact of the disease. But it also increases the risk of spreading the disease when you're putting people together. So are there models that will solve the problem? No, but I think people are trying to do work to help provide insight into how the system will work.
There's an international side to this problem as well. What is that side in terms of distributing a vaccine to people around the world? Is the World Health Organization, WHO, responding well enough?
Well, the WHO has basically announced that we are in a pandemic. What's interesting right now is because our flu season tends to be in the fall into the winter, we can look in the southern hemisphere and see what is happening there. And in fact, a recent report came out on the 2009 H1N1 virus down in New Zealand, and it's showing the typical pattern of a very precipitous rise in the incidence of H1N1. In fact, if we look at the charts, H1N1 has become the most dominant influenza that is being seen in New Zealand right now, even more so than their seasonal flu.
So by all means, we have to take this seriously.
We have to take it seriously. There still are a tremendous amount of unknowns. Probably the biggest one is, what will the mortality rate be? We just don't know it right now. And how widely will it be spread and how people will be affected? A fairly large percentage of people who end up with the seasonal flu show absolutely no symptoms. They're completely asymptomatic, yet they have the disease. We will see that to some degree with the pandemic H1N1. In addition, people who are older than around 50 or so, who were potentially exposed to the 1957 pandemic as well as the pandemic in the late 1960s, may have some partial immunity so that the disease may not be as virulent in them. We just don't know at this point. We can make our best guesses, and it's only with 2020 hindsight that we will look back and realize exactly what happened. But at this point, we're in a very challenging situation, not just in the United States, but basically worldwide.
I'd like to switch our conversation just slightly. I know that you specialize not only in immunization, but you've written about things as widespread as basketball handicapping and the effect of obesity on driving. Let's look at one area that you've written about a great deal, and that's vaccinations for children. Every year, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, publishes a schedule of recommended vaccines. I understand that the schedule is growing longer and longer. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's becoming much more complex to the point that the traditional healthcare provider is being overwhelmed to be able to satisfy this schedule. The cost of immunization has also skyrocketed, and vaccine manufacturers who have become very adept at developing new vaccines, and in particular in combining antigens into what are typically referred to as combination vaccines, have made the schedule and the decision-making process even more complex. So we have done a tremendous amount of work in trying to understand and help the public health community unravel these issues using some very fundamental issues in optimization as well as game theory and stochastic models to do that. And the results we've come up with are quite fascinating because we've been able to provide real guidance to organizations and show them that there are choices available to them and there are better choices for them to make than maybe what they're already doing. It's a very ad hoc process in the public health community, yet operations research is so uniquely well-defined to help address these problems. And we've been in a great situation to be able to do that.
Well, we'll get into some of your recommendations very soon. I did want to ask, are there children who are not receiving recommended vaccines, and why is that, limiting ourselves to the United States in particular?
Well, it turns out in the United States we're doing an extremely good job of immunizing our children. somewhere in the order of, you know, single digits, 5 to 10% of children are not receiving the full spectrum of vaccines that are required to satisfy the recommended child immunization schedule. Some of the reasons vary. Some of it is economics, even though there are wonderful programs set up in the federal government, like the Vaccine for Children program, that basically provide vaccines to families and children who are not in an economic situation to be able to afford them. At the same time, there are certain people and organizations that have a philosophical issue against vaccines. There's been a tremendous controversy concerning MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella, and the impact on autism. Although there is nothing that indicates there is a relationship, some people feel concerned of giving that vaccine and, in fact, overwhelming a child's immune system with so many vaccines that potentially there can be implications on their long-term health.
Okay. One issue is whether children are receiving their vaccines on schedule. What's the problem when children don't receive vaccines on schedule?
If children do not receive their vaccines on schedule, they are more vulnerable to having or getting infected with the disease that the vaccines are trying to prevent. If enough children are vulnerable, eventually we will see an uptick in the number of cases. The impact on this locally is that people are being sick, but the national impact is healthcare costs. Vaccines are a wonderful investment. Different estimates have been made on the cost-benefit of each dollar of vaccine money spent, and it ranges anywhere for as little as $5 of value is gained for every dollar spent to, in some cases, over $20 for every dollar spent. This is an enormous amount of value in immunization, and in the current healthcare environment that they're working in, where we're trying to reduce costs and provide better care, if we lose that advantage, healthcare costs will, in essence, continue to spiral out of control along the specter.
On another issue that's related, you work a lot at creating these combination vaccines and finding the right mix. What problem does administering vaccines in combination help solve? And as a corollary, how are combination vaccines a way of ensuring that more children are vaccinated?
Well, combination vaccines, the advantage of them is that it requires fewer injections to a child to be able to satisfy the recommended childhood immunization schedule. The downside is that you now have to create a puzzle to satisfy the schedule, where when you had monovalent or single antigen vaccines, you simply put them in one at a time. Now you have, in fact, many choices, but the combinatorial nightmare that results for the public health community and particular healthcare providers is much more sophisticated. It really requires some OR thinking to be able to solve the problem.
Let's switch our focus for a moment from the consumer or patient to the business side. Pricing vaccines is important for competing pharmaceutical companies. Why is it so hard to do, and what does the math modeler have to offer?
Well, the pharmaceutical industry is ultimately in a position that they want to provide their products for the well-being of a community, of a country, in our case, the United States. At the same time, they need to be financially viable. If you look at some of the older, more mature vaccines, for example, polio, which has been around quite a while, it is relatively inexpensive to purchase. While if you look at some of the newer vaccines, for example, if we look at the pneumococcal vaccine, that is much more expensive. So the vaccine manufacturers are in a position that as new vaccines come in, they can price them more commensurate with the investment they've made with their development of the product, while the older vaccines, that investment is long paid for, they're at a much less expensive price. These are all issues which, in fact, initially drove people out of the market because there wasn't enough money to be made by the pharmaceutical industry, but more recently is bringing pharmaceutical companies back into the market because, in essence, there is money to be made. The vaccine industry is a multi-billion dollar industry, and the kinds of tools that we use, in particular using ideas, for example, from optimization and game theory, enable us to look at the players in the system and find mutually beneficial pricing models, which not only help pharmaceutical industries price their products, but also help the consumer get the product still at a reasonable price, but enable the manufacturer to stay in the business and even attract more business in the future.
We only have time for a few more questions. We often hear of vaccine shortages for children and adults. What causes these shortages?
Well, it goes down to grassroots issues, production problems. Quite often, a plant may experience some kind of fire or shutdown. They could be out of compliance when it comes to Food and Drug Administration requirements. And all these things can shut down a facility. And given that situation, there can potentially be a shortage. When that occurs, then satisfying the recommended child immunization schedule becomes a challenge. You know, there are over 4 million children born in the United States every single year. And the schedule, which has vaccines valued at over $1,000, just doing the math, you realize this is a multi-billion dollar business. If there's a vaccine shortage and children do not get immunized, the potential for spreading of the disease is much greater simply because people will be much more vulnerable, and we end up in the kind of situation where healthcare costs start to skyrocket. All of these things are connected to each other. We're not dealing with a silo of situations. We're dealing with a complex system across the entire society.
And finally, how optimistic are you that we'll solve the problems that we've been talking about today in time to prevent a serious medical crisis?
Well, solving may not be the right word. Will we be able to weather the storm? Absolutely. We're a very resilient country, and the world, in some sense, will come together in this crisis. But at the same time, it's not going to be without a price. This is a very challenging situation. The hope is that we're going to learn a tremendous amount from it so that in the future, when such an incident occurs, we'll be able to, in fact, mitigate the impact of it much better. We've already learned from the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. We've learned from other pandemics we've seen in the 20th century. We will certainly learn from this one as well.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Sheldon Jacobson of the University of Illinois about his work in immunization. Professor, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.